The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and today we're going to look at how trade and currency affects our health, our choices, and maybe our ethics. A little later, we'll speak to Nora Sesh, professor of industrial economics, who's done some research on how markets may impact our morals. But let's begin by talking about how commerce has spread disease throughout history. I'm here with Mark Harrison, professor of the history of medicine and director of the Wellcome Unit for the History of Medicine at the University of Oxford. His previous books include Medicine and Victory, British Military Medicine in the Second World War, and The Medical War, British Military Medicine in the First World War, and for each of which he was awarded the Templar Medal. His new book is Contagion, How Commerce Has Spread Disease. Wonderful to have you here, Mark.
I'm happy to be here.
So let's talk about the Black Death. In your book, you outlined a possible route by which it could have been spread, but you do say that this kind of thing is very difficult to trace back. Why is that?
Well, it's mostly because of the sources, really. I mean, at the moment, there are very few good records of the Black Death, or more accurately at that time, the plague, because it wasn't called the Black Death until much, much later. There's not much information about it until it arrives in Central Asia, in the port of Kaffa. From then on, it's well documented. But prior to that, really, we're just left to speculate. I mean, there are bits and pieces of information about mass deaths occurring in different parts of Asia, including China. But there's no firm evidence that would link those to plague. It's just, I guess, you know, some people think certain kinds of evidence are more persuasive than others.
Well, since we can agree that this is fairly speculative, maybe just walk us through how it could have happened.
Well, I think the most likely explanation is that it started in China, in probably somewhere like Yunnan province, which was later the origin of outbreaks of plague, which subsequently became pandemic. For instance, the one in the 1890s, which is called the third plague pandemic by many people, that began in Yunnan province. I think the most likely reason is that in Yunnan, there's a wild reservoir of plague, which has been there probably for many thousands of years. And around that time, there are reports in China of large numbers of people dying. This is in the 1330s, preceding the outbreak of the Black Death in Central Asia. And I think the numbers of people who are dying then, at least as far as the sources say, are probably so large that it would probably be something like a plague that was causing it. I can't really think what else would be able to cause that kind of mortality. Because of the numbers who died, and because plague has broken out so often in that part of China before, I would favor that as the origin. And then I think it spread from there, most likely by trade along the Silk Roads to Central Asia, where it's recorded in the merchant community at Kaffa. And from then, I think the directions of plague were really many and varied, but they're fairly well documented, spread all over the Middle East to North Africa, and of course up into Europe in the course of the last few years of the 1340s.
Now, are there pieces of that hypothesis that don't fit? Because you said that was sort of the one with the best evidence. So why might someone disagree with this one?
I think it's because the sources prior to the outbreak in Kaffa in the 1340s are just not very specific, and that's the problem. And I think that there are some people who are just very reluctant to pin down any kind of origin. And then, of course, there are other people who want to put forward a different explanation simply because that's the way, you know, that's the way academics and historians work. I think, you know, people thrive on controversy. Controversy sells books and so on. So I think, I'm not a psychologist, but it's very, very hard to, I think, to find any really cast iron explanation for for where plague originated at that time. But for me, the balance on balance, I would say China is probably the most likely.
Well, and this is my question. Are there good reasons for trying to trace the spread of a history-old disease when it is largely speculative?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to put too much emphasis on it personally. I just think that if you're going to write about the Black Death, to totally duck the question is a bit of a cop-out. But I think what interested me was primarily what happened after it got to the Black Sea, after it spread quite clearly from the Black Sea to Europe, to North Africa and other parts of the Middle East, largely by trade. It's really from that point on that it was particularly interesting to me. What happened before was interesting and maybe relevant, but because there was no firm evidence, I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time speculating about it. I think we're going to have to wait for maybe more documentary evidence. Possibly, I think the best chance of solving the question in future will be if there is good ancient DNA evidence from certain parts of Central Asia, which shows that people had died from plague. That's the only thing which is, I think, going to finally persuade people.
Well, the particular route might be in question, but the political responses were not. And your book gets very, very deep into the various policy decisions that were made around the spread of disease. So how did you choose those case studies?
Through the medieval period, you mean, into the early modern period? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think some of them are case studies that many people look at because they are quite clearly kind of major turning points. For instance, the first time that something like quarantine is used, or the first occasion on which, the 40-day period of detention, which is the kind of technical period of the period which sort of gives rise to the term quarantine. Those are kind of landmarks in a sense. But I mean, after that, the choice of case studies really depended on the extent to which there was either some kind of controversy among merchants and public health officials over how best to deal with the threat of plague. Or I guess the other thing would be where there was some kind of noteworthy statement about how people thought the plague was transmitted, and the role of merchants in particular. So it's really a case of kind of just looking for case studies which enabled me to show popular attitudes towards plague and its relationship to trade, and also ones where I could quite clearly show that there was some tension between merchants and magistrates and doctors and other public health officials, because there was, an increasing amount of tension at that time, particularly in the time you get into, the Renaissance.
Well, you wrote in your book that it's difficult for historians to explain sanitary regulations over time because they're presented as advances in enlightened government. The political aspects are often ignored then?
Well, it's not that the political aspects are ignored always. I mean, the issue is the extent to which public health measures were a proportionate response to disease or the threat of disease. It's often the case that other factors enter into the consideration of the people who have responsibility for public health. So they have to weigh up the risk of disease quite clearly. And the risk of disease is going to affect the decision whether or not to impose quarantine against ships coming from a certain part of the world, for example. But other factors will also enter into that. And that is really, in that sense, I'm kind of stressing the politics. And those factors can be, public opinion in a country, or particularly in a port city, what people expect to be done. That's obviously very important. The opinion of other countries who may be affected by quarantine and other public health measures, the effects that it has on their trade. I mean, these sort of bilateral connections and later, I suppose, international dimensions of that really affect quite markedly how governments and port authorities respond to the threat of disease. In some cases, I think there are countries which actually introduce public health measures or prepare to impose quarantine simply to satisfy the expectations of other countries, rather than because they see that there's a strong likelihood of disease being transmitted into their ports. So those are some of the political considerations, but obviously plague did give rise to a lot of fear. And I think, you know, obviously if plague got into a country, then, you know, the effects on the economy, the effects on, you know, on public order could be dreadful. So I guess governments did tend to err on the side of caution.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Mark Harrison, author of Contagion, How Commerce Has Spread Disease. Let's look at how public health was used, I guess, as a weapon, really.
Yeah.
Tell us about the history of the quarantine.
Well, quarantine started in the 1340s, just after the first outbreaks of plague in Europe, after it spread from the Black Sea. And pretty much, I guess it was at that point, not so much a medical decision, but the decision of magistrates. Many of the doctors were actually quite skeptical about quarantine to begin with. Plague didn't really fit into their view of what disease was. I mean, their view of disease was based on the old sort of Galenic, ancient Greek principles of the balance of the humours, the constituent fluid parts of the body. So it was really the magistrates that took the initiative, and it was really seen as a form of, I guess, of responsible statecraft to keep disease out of your country, out of your state. And it started off in Renaissance Italy, and it spread gradually along the Mediterranean. I mean, largely because the Mediterranean was most at risk from the spread of plague from Central Asia and the Middle East. And it was usually the wool trade at that point, or later the trade in cotton, that became closely associated with the spread of plague. And then after a time, quarantine is taken up a bit later on, say particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries, by many countries in the north of Europe. And the obvious explanation for that is, well, yes, I mean, plague regularly did follow the movement of merchants. And it was necessary to take some measure in order to prevent economic disruption, to prevent civil unrest in your countries. But states increasingly found that quarantine had other uses, that it could be used, for instance, to damage the interests of rival nations. You could try to keep the trade out of your ports. You could try to protect your own industries, your own agricultural producers. And also you could use quarantine, particularly land quarantine, as a way of screening undesirable people from coming into your country or into your city. So quarantine had a whole panoply of uses which were very attractive to people who were beginning to build up the state, to build up the machinery of governance in many parts of Europe.
You mentioned the economic effect, but that could really go either way, though, because a quarantine held a financial cost for the parties. But if there was a plague in your region and people were afraid to buy from you because your goods might carry it, they might not buy it at all then. And the fact that you'd been through a quarantine gave consumers some peace of mind.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's always two sides, you know, to this equation, I think. And I think, in the case of the people who are trying to use quarantine to damage the trade of rivals, I mean, there's a certain amount of short-termism there. But I guess, I mean, there's a kind of calculation as, you know, to the effect that, okay, you know, if we impose a quarantine, it's probably going to be detrimental to our own commerce to some extent, to our own merchants, but it's going to affect theirs more.
Right.
So it's really a kind of a balance, I think.
So then maybe you could give us some examples of how the quarantine was used.
And for instance, I mean, there was a lot of tension between Britain and Spain during the 17th century and into the 18th century. And Britain had, in the course of wars against Spain, managed to acquire some territories which are still disputed, such as Gibraltar, for instance. Now, one of the ways that in the 18th century, after the British gained Gibraltar, one of the ways in which they were able to annoy the British and to try to damage their interest in the region was to put Gibraltar regularly under quarantine, trying to prevent ships from Gibraltar landing in Spanish ports. But they also tried to put pressure on some of the neighboring countries like Portugal, which of course had formerly been under Spanish rule. And there was a lot of threat and intimidation by the Spanish towards the Portuguese to try to get them to do that. And occasionally they would relent and try to impose quarantines against some of the British ships. So this was very damaging to British traders in the region. Both those coming from Europe, from Britain itself, and also the British traders who were based in places like Gibraltar, but also particularly in the Portuguese. So some of the Portuguese cities there, like Porto. The Spanish did this, used sometimes, obviously, the threat was justified, but on other occasions, the British thought they were doing it on the pretext of the threat of plague without any really good evidence. And the British tried in their turn to put pressure on the Portuguese, and the Portuguese were really caught in the middle. You know, one day the Spanish ambassador would be trying to persuade them to impose quarantine against British ships. The next day, the British ambassador would be giving them, you know, quite unsubtle, sometimes subtle threats as to what they would do if they did impose quarantine. So there was a kind of, it was used quite a lot by the Spanish in lieu of military action to try and frustrate British power, mercantile power in the region. I mean, this was a time when commerce was seen to be very important in building up the wealth of nations, and in which war was increasingly directed to frustrating commerce in one way or another by whether it's attacking merchant vessels or denying them access to certain parts of the world. Commerce was seen to be the lifeblood of nations increasingly, and most countries would use whatever means they could to frustrate that. In some cases, during war, of course, they would deliberately attack the vessels of another power. But very often, even in peacetime, when there was a lot of tension, they would choose to use a measure like quarantine. And that's why I think it's really was used, particularly in the 18th century, as a form of war by other means.
Well, and so that's what I'm wondering, because you keep saying form of war, but did the implementation of a quarantine actually provoke a war at any time?
Well, it certainly provoked hostilities, yes. I mean, there was some, sometimes in the Mediterranean, there would be reprisals against states or ports which had imposed quarantine. For instance, there were some states in the southern Mediterranean area on the North African coast. They were actually among the first Muslim states to use quarantine. Some of those states were governed by the so-called Barbary pirates or Barbary corsairs. And there was a lot of tension between them anyway and some of the European ports on the northern shore of the Mediterranean. And occasionally the Barbary corsairs would impose quarantine on some European vessels coming from southern France or part different Italian states, for instance. And sometimes those states would respond and in military terms by sending fleet to some of the to places like Tunis or some of the other ports on the North African coast and would bombard them for a while in reprisal. So yes, I mean, it did actually lead to military conflict at times. On other occasions, quarantines, land quarantines or cordon sanitaire were actually turned into invasion forces as well. So that's not exactly a case of quarantine leading to war. It's actually a case of the quarantine going to war. And that happened on a few occasions. Basically, you could say on the pretext of fear of an epidemic or an outbreak of disease, such as plague and later on even yellow fever, countries would line their borders with very large numbers of troops as a precaution to try to prevent people coming in to their territory. In other words, to try and keep disease out. So occasionally, where there were predatory intentions, these forces could be used to go into another territory and then annex it, because you could build up forces by stealth, really, by claiming that they were there for sanitary purposes. The Prussians did that in the 1770s to annex parts of Poland. The French did it in 1823 to put down the liberal government in Spain and to restore the Bourbon monarchy. So, I mean, that's another example of how quarantine is linked to war or invasion.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back after these messages with more of Mark Harrison and his book, Contagion, How Commerce Has Spread Disease.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Mark Harrison, director of the Wellcome Unit for the History of Medicine at the University of Oxford. We're talking about his newest book, Contagion: How Commerce Has Spread Disease. So now, different countries definitely held different positions on the quarantine process as a whole, and they seem to have changed throughout. So what were those positions based on?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer because, you know, it tends to be quite a different balance of factors in different cases. But, I mean, typically what's involved are, you know, the extent to which a country has mercantile interests. Countries with strong mercantile interests, where trade is very substantial element in their ability to raise revenue. I mean, that's those states, for instance, Britain in the 18th, 19th century, tend to be less keen on quarantine for obvious reasons, because, you know, very strict quarantines or arbitrary quarantines are going to be very disruptive to their trade. Other countries which derive more of their revenue, say, from agriculture and farming revenue from agriculture, those countries tend to be rather more keen on quarantine. Good examples would be Russia, Prussia, Austria-Hungary, for instance. But of course, these things do change over time. The economic aspect is one, obviously, going to be a key consideration in many cases. Political philosophy, to the extent that can be separated from economics, is also really important. I mean, some states have a more liberal tradition, you know, a strong democratic tradition. Others have a tendency towards authoritarianism. And quarantine tends to be more closely, I suppose, associated with conservatives, whether within any particular country or with regimes which tend towards conservatism and authoritarianism. So again, you know, that also could explain why historically countries such as Russia have been much more keen on imposing quarantine, or say Austria-Hungary, than some other countries with a more liberal tradition, because they can actually use quarantine as a way of controlling population in a way that probably wouldn't be quite as acceptable, or at least as acceptable for such a long time in a country like United Kingdom, for instance.
Right.
So that's two. I mean, that's two things. I mean, the economics and the sort of the political traditions are very important, but then there's lots of other factors, really, which
none of them being science. Hey. None of
them. Science is important, but of course, science is universal up to a point. I mean, there's very rarely been a kind of stable consensus over the causation of disease. There's always some room for maneuver in a scientific sense where not everyone agrees exactly. But very often, I mean, there is a sort of more or less consensus position over, say, something like how plague is spread in the 18th century or the 19th century. But even though that may exist, countries do things very, very differently, or want to do them very differently. So even at, say, I mean, a really good example would be at the very end of the 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, when there's a good sort of amount of agreement about how plague is spread, or the extent to which it's contagious, or indeed, say, cholera, that countries still tend to do things very differently. At that point in time, there was an increasing agreement among the Western powers about how to deal with those diseases, and that meant really scaling back traditional quarantine, making it less disruptive. But the Japanese, which emerged at that time as an imperial power, went exactly the other way and wanted to have incredibly strict quarantine in their own country and also throughout their empire. So at that point, the same scientific information is being interpreted in radically different ways. So science is, of course, important, but it's, I would say, not usually decisive. It's kind of brought into play by people who want to have a particular kind of sanitary policy for some other reason.
Was there a push to actually try to develop consistent sanitary standards?
Yes, there was. I mean, that started in the 19th century in a particularly strong way. I mean, there were a few sporadic and unsuccessful attempts to do that before, for instance, among some of the Italian states in the 17th and the 18th centuries. But in the middle of the 19th century, some countries had quite a strong desire to standardize things. Britain and France, in particular, led the way because they had strong commercial interests, and they really wanted to do away with the kind of arbitrary system of quarantine which then existed in the Mediterranean, where maybe one court would impose a quarantine of 30 days and another one would do nothing at all. And this was very damaging to trade. You needed far more certainty. So they led the way to try to get an international agreement. And it looked for a time like some of the other countries would follow suit. But when they finally had a meeting gathering to try to hammer out some of these issues, which happened in France in 1850, they couldn't agree. Britain and France wanted to liberalize quarantine, standardize it, but countries such as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Russia, the Italian states really weren't having any of that. And they wanted to maintain control over their quarantine and to have pretty strong sanitary regulations. So that was unsuccessful to begin with. But by the very end of the 19th century, with the exception of Japan, as I've just mentioned, there was more agreement that it would be a good idea to target sanitary measures more effectively, to rely on surveillance of disease in different countries so that you could do that, to have more emphasis on cleaning up ports and preventing disease getting into ships than imposing quarantine once ships actually arrived. And the main reason driving that was the growth of the global economy. Increasingly, countries felt that they had a stake in the freedom of trade. It wasn't just Britain or France, for instance, that was pressing for it by the 1890s. There were many countries that saw that the smooth working of the global economy was really vital to their interests. And then they began to sort of fall in more with the kind of proposals that the British had been putting forward for some time.
Well, tell us about the sanitary standards that we have globally right now.
Well, the sanitary standards we have now are based on something called the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement, which was signed by most countries in 1995. It's really established at the same time as the World Trade Organization. It's the World Trade Organization, which is the ultimate arbiter in cases of disputes between countries over how to interpret the rules. And there are quite a lot of disputes over this. But countries set their own regulations, but they have to do so in a way which is commensurate with these international guidelines, which were laid down in 1995. The problem is that there's quite a few loopholes, I think, in this agreement. I mean, it's really open to quite a lot of interpretation. I mean, all agreements are, obviously, all law is open to interpretation. But I think there's quite a lot of slack in this agreement, and that enables countries to really take measures sometimes which go beyond medical advice. I suppose a really good example of that was in 2009 during the H1N1 outbreak, the so-called swine flu outbreak. There was a lot of concern, of course, about the mortality that was going to arise from the disease, particularly in the first few months. And that gave rise to a fair amount of panic in different parts of the world. But immediately, many countries decided to ban imports of not just live animals, live pigs, but also pork products. And there was no scientific reason for doing that at the time. And the World Health Organization eventually issued a statement which made it quite clear that there was no health risk from consuming pork. Yet many countries retained their bans on pork from North America, from Mexico and the US, and even Canada, in spite of the fact that there was no good evidence that it was spread by the trade in pork meat. But the SPS agreement of 1995 has a clause which enables states to take measures which really could go beyond international guidelines if they think that the science is inconclusive or there's some other good reason for doing so. And of course, that's always argued over ferociously. But in 2009, there were many governments which maintained this ban for quite a long time, say, for instance, the Chinese. So I think we have what is now clearly a global framework for interpreting sanitary disputes, but we still have a lot of disputes which arise because the regulations are probably not as tight as some people would like.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Mark Harrison, professor of the history of medicine at Oxford and author of Contagion, How Commerce Has Spread Disease. Okay, now I want to dig in. Since you mentioned H1N1, I'd like to dig into a more contemporary disease. And it's not H1N1 and it's not SARS because I live in Alberta. So I want to talk about BSE. Mm-hmm. How did that go down?
Well, BSC, yes. I mean, this is quite a complex question because the issues play out differently in different countries. I mean, obviously, Britain was, you know, the origin of the BSC outbreak, and the issues which surfaced in Britain were, or at least the way things played out, were a little bit different from in other countries because it was the first place to experience a large outbreak of BSC. But what happened in Britain, in a nutshell, was that in the 1980s. People started to notice that there were cases of death among cattle, which resembled, in some cases, you know, in many ways, cases of scrapie among sheep. Cattle were behaving very oddly. They were clearly displaying neurological problems, and then they invariably died. And, you know, I suppose probably in the past there have been maybe one or two cases of a, you know, similar nature in previous years, but in the 1980s there seemed to be an awful lot, and it became clear that all these cattle deaths were due to probably a single disease. For some time, there was a lot of discussion over what was causing it. The government set up a committee to investigate this. And in 1988, I think it was, they reached their conclusion and decided that the disease was spread by something called a prion, which was a malformed protein, and that it was probably spread in feed that had been the feed that was composed of animal matter. So basically herbivores were being fed with meat, and to many people, of course, that seemed very unnatural. But this appeared to have been going on for some time, and so infected meat carrying these malformed prions had found its way in to the food chain at some point, probably during the 1970s, and had been used very extensively since then. And probably after an incubation period of maybe, you know, I don't know exactly how old it is in cattle, but certainly it was the case that probably during the 1980s there were numerous cases of with feed being used, which were using animal matter, and large numbers of cows died from this. And I think overall there were something like, and of course we still have occasional cases of BSE now, I think something like 184,000 cases BSC among cattle in Britain. So this disease was obviously a huge problem for farmers at first, but then people started to become very worried that meats containing or animal products containing these malformed prions would find their way into the human food chain. And in the late 1980s, people began to be very nervous about the prospect of humans developing something like BSC, and the government tried their best to reassure them, saying that they'd just banned the use of animal feed, and that the problem of BSE is likely to decline, and that there was no evidence either that it could spread from cattle to humans. In other words, that no evidence that it could jump species. The public weren't terribly reassured by this, and so the government had to do a lot to try to play down public fears. And of course, there was in 1993, so this was going on for some time before there was any conclusive proof that it could jump species. In 1993, I think it was the Agriculture Minister, or Secretary of State for Agriculture, John Selwyn Gummer, famously attempted to persuade his daughter to consume a beef burger made from British beef, and she wasn't terribly pleased by that. And I think that one moment came to define his whole career, which is very unfortunate. He became a kind of laughing stock in Britain because his daughter was reluctant to eat the beef burger. And it kind of summed up the fact that the public weren't terribly reassured by what the government was saying. And then in 1995, it became clear that public concern was well founded. There was the first case of something like BSC in a human being, which occurred in Britain that year. The disease was subsequently called variant CJD because it was very similar to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which had occurred for many years among human beings and was well recognized. But this variant was slightly different. And although for some months, the government and some of the some medical scientists and public health officers tried to play down a connection with BSE. Eventually, it was admitted. And in 1996, it was kind of officially announced that variant CJD was basically a human form of BSE and the spread most likely in contaminated meat products, probably those containing neurological tissue. And really, at that point, the European countries that traded with Britain became very concerned and imposed a ban on British beef, which turned out to be very unpopular, of course, in Britain. And the then Prime Minister, John Major, announced a beef war against the European Union, and at the same time imposed a ban on the sale of beef on the bone, which is not very popular either, and it was openly flouted in many cases. And so this that was the kind of, in a nutshell, how things developed. But really, from that point on, I can see, I can draw, I suppose, a kind of really from the point, really from, I guess, a point of about 1996, it was clear that, you know, the BSE issue gave rise to a number of, well, really, a number of concerns which were far more universal, really, which were picked up by people well outside of Britain. I mean, the first was a kind of skepticism about official announcements, whether they were by medical officers or who were employed by the government or by the governments themselves about sanitary concerns. And I think when BSE later spread to other countries, or when it became clear that countries may be importing beef from other countries which had been infected by BSE, there was a reluctance to trust official announcements. And I think that had a lot to do with how the issue was handled in Britain. The other issue which occurred was that BSE became the subject of a kind of trade war between Britain and the, you know, other European Union countries. And the tension was greatest between Britain and France. Even after British beef was declared safe, the French continued to impose a ban on imports of British beef. Eventually, Britain went to the European Court of Justice, got a ruling in its favour, and still the French maintained this ban for some time. And that subsequently was something which came to characterise the BSE issue when it surfaced in other countries. There were a lot of fears about, on the one hand, it being used to justify protectionism, people protecting their own farmers against cheap foreign competition. And on the other hand, there was a lot of scepticism about sanitary standards being lowered because of the pressure of one usually richer or more powerful country upon another. So I think those two things, the tendency to distrust official pronouncements and the tendency for BSE to figure in trade disputes, really kind of stem from the mid-90s, first of all in the British case, but later on you can see that in many other parts of the world.
Well, you mentioned many other parts of the world. I do have to just mention South Korea, because BSE had a huge impact on them.
It certainly did, and it certainly is still a controversy now. I was in South Korea a couple of weeks ago speaking about this, and it really does continue to engage the public, and you know, there's a great deal, you know, very passionately, because there's a huge, I suppose, a very long-standing fear that BSE, which has never occurred in South Korea, will come into the country with imports of beef, principally from the United States. That's the main concern. Up until 2003, the South Koreans imported probably more beef from the United States than any other country. And it was a really significant part of the US export market. In 2010, the amount of beef the Americans were exporting to South Korea had nearly halved. And what happened in the intervening years was that after some initial scares over BSE, reports of cases of BSE in the United States around 2003, the South Koreans imposed a ban on American beef. This was later lifted, but then there seemed to be some accusations of irregularities in the imports, and the beef ban was reestablished in 2006. South Korea wasn't the only country which introduced the ban. Japan also did at that point. But then in 2008, a new president in South Korea, a conservative president, Lee Byung-bak, entered into a free trade agreement in a very secretive way with the United States. And this raised a lot of suspicion in South Korea, because one part of this agreement appeared to be that the South Koreans would have to start taking American beef again. It seemed to be a kind of quid pro quo for getting the United States to sign a free trade agreement. And so the South Koreans felt that they were being lent on by the Americans, and that they were being basically forced to accept beef, which wasn't safe. I mean, that was the perception of many Koreans anyway. But the beef issue, or the BSE issue, had really tremendous importance beyond the free trade agreement, which was obviously very controversial in its own right. It also was a way of, I suppose, bringing together disparate parts of the population to oppose the new president, who was becoming very unpopular at that point for other reasons, because he'd been elected on a kind of neoliberal platform, really, which involved significant public sector reforms, trade union legislation, and various other things which were unpopular, but obviously particularly with the trade unions, but also with the opposition party. And so there were people, I think, who saw that the beef issue was a way of kind of broadening the scope of opposition to the new president. And so by the end of June 2008, there were tens of thousands, then in some cases over 100,000 people gathering almost every night in the center of Seoul to protest against the lifting of the beef ban, the president's declaration that he was going to do that. And these disputes were mostly good-natured. They weren't just the kind of the usual suspects. They're kind of the political activists. They involved people who, you know, were ordinary, quite clear, sort of ordinary concerned citizens, mothers, young children, for instance. And there was a lot of genuine fear, but the fear was also, I think, to some extent, stoked by people who wanted to use it for domestic political purposes. But it didn't stop the beef ban being lifted, and the protests were met with, you know, quite determined opposition in some cases by the police, and they became quite nasty by the beginning of July. And eventually there was a police crackdown, and many of the people leading the so-called People's Conference Against Mad Cow Disease were arrested. And the protests became more muted after that. But the issue still hasn't gone away. I mean, in 2012, there was a single case of BSE in California. This is in April 2012. And it started to arouse some of those old passions. But I don't think it was anything like what happened in 2008. The political situation was entirely different. The president was on his way out. It's his last year of office. So I think that kind of shows that on the one hand, the political context is really all important when we're interpreting the risks, sanitary risks from trade or sanitary risks from anything else. The science was more or less the same, but the political context was entirely different.
So then are public health issues just always going to be politicized? Is there any way around that at all?
Not really.
All right.
you just have to accept it, I think. And I think once you know that, you know, it's not to say that it's all political. It's not to say that it's all derived from kind of science. I mean, it's the interplay of science and politics. But we have to accept that there's always going to be an element of politics. I mean, that is inevitable. But I think knowing that these things are political kind of helps us to understand, I think, the way things work in a much more sophisticated way. I think there's a tendency to try to solve arguments by always referring them to some kind of independent arbiter, which we call science, which is, you know, supposedly neutral, objective, and value-free. Well, it never has worked like that. It never will. And we just have to accept that. And I think that's in a sense a good thing, because I think it gets people to talk to each other more. It should be a kind of invitation to more sophisticated forms of dialogue, both kind of internationally at the level of global institutions and also kind of at a local level. I mean, trust is incredibly important. I mean, that's the BSE issue in Britain and South Korea shows that. People need to be open about sanitary concerns. They need to be open about, you know, the open about the nature of the risks. I think there's often been a tendency to hype risks, and that leads to public distrust, just as much as concealment in some cases. So I think there's a need for, on the part of governments, on the part of public health officers, this need to kind of be very temperate in how they put across risks, or, you know, say from the risk of infection from trade, or, you know, estimates of mortalities from, or morbidity from epidemics, that kind of thing. I think they need to emphasize that this is a kind of an imperfect science, and that there's always going to be room for miscalculation. Because I think kind of lurid statements about, you know, tens of thousands of people dying from, say, something like, maybe millions of people dying from epidemics of H1N1, and in fact, actually in the BSE case, those led to a lot of public mistrust of scientists and of governments. People just, I think now, believe that sometimes public health officers are crying wolf, and that could be a very dangerous one. So I think there's a need to be very temperate about these sort of public announcements, to recognize, you know, the limits of science, the limits of epidemiology, and, you know, to accept that there's a gray area there, which is the domain of politics.
Mark, wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
You can find a link to Mark Harrison and his book, Contagion, How Commerce Has Spread Disease, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the break, I'll be speaking with Nora Sesh about how markets may erode moral concerns. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at science history with two books about the passion and perseverance that drive scientific discovery. We're joined by science writer Mark Anderson to talk about his book, The Day the World Discovered the Sun, an extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. And science writer Jessica Wapner returns to discuss her new book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, a mutant gene and the quest to cure cancer at the genetic level. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Professor of Industrial Economics, Nora Sesh. She's worked on market and auction design, customer behavior, and market failures. She works with models from standard and from behavioral economic theory, as well as with empirical methods, that is, experiments. Good to have you with us, Nora.
Yeah, thank you for having me there.
Now, you just completed a study that looked at how markets affect moral values. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, sure. So what we find is that markets have indeed a causal effect on our moral behavior. We invite people to take a decision whether they want to save the life of a mouse or whether they want to kill a mouse and receive a monetary amount. And we find that people, when deciding in a non-market context, individually, the majority of people prefer to save the mouse life. But in markets, we get a completely different picture. There, up to 80% of people are willing to sell the life of their mouse for comparatively low monetary amounts. So really, moral behavior differs drastically whether people are in markets or outside of them.
Well, maybe tell us a bit about your study design. How did you work that out?
Yeah, so to understand whether markets have this causal influence, we had to randomize people into different setups. Some of the people that we invited to our study, and these were mostly students from various fields, they were randomized into a market condition, and others were randomized into an individual decision context, such that we can really see whether this market institution has an impact on how people decide. Yeah, so this was the main means to make sure that basically the same people decide differently depending on in which institution they are in.
Okay, so if I was one of the participants in that study, what would I have been doing? Walk me through that.
You come into the concert hall where we ran this experiment. We had to use a big concert hall because we wanted to be quick with that. We wanted to elicit behavior of many people in fast time so people don't start to talk about the study. And then you would be randomized into one of the rooms, and then either an individual decision would confront you. You would take your decision on a laptop. You would get an instruction via instruction screen, and then you could decide whether you want to save the mouse or kill it and receive the monetary amount of €10. And you would also be perfectly informed about killing process and also about the living conditions if you would decide that the mouse should survive. Living conditions are actually really good in the sense that mice get good food, good living conditions, they get medical care and so on. If you would be randomized into a market context, again, you would sit in front of a laptop. It would be anonymous, so you would not see the others you are trading with in this sense. You would just start to negotiate prices via the laptop. So you would just enter price offers, and you would either be randomized into the role of a seller or of a buyer, and you would have to try to find a trader of the other side such that you can, together with the other trader, if you want to, trade and kill a mouse. If you don't want that, then you just don't trade.
So are those results, well, first of all, tell us about your results.
So as I told you, what we find in the market situations is that many more people are willing to agree to the killing of a mouse. They are willing to sell their mouse for monetary amounts that are comparatively low, below 10 euros, and in larger markets, often below 5 euros, actually. And this is very much in contrast to the individual decisions. There, most people saved their mouse. So 45% of people were willing to agree to the killing and the individual treatment. And this is, of course, much less than these market conditions.
Okay, so how does one interpret that? Or how did you guys interpret that?
This shows that the markets causally affect the behavior, right? Because as the people got randomized into these different treatments, the treatment must be the reason why people behave differently. And this was an institutional change across treatments, right? So it's really the market setup that seems to tempt people into agreeing to something they consider as immoral. Actually, it really seems that people express their true standards in the individual treatments. Because in the market treatments, what we find is that people regret their decisions afterwards. So if you ask those that decided to kill a mouse in the market treatments, people typically say that they feel remorse.
So if one was to extrapolate that to our current market system, I guess it says nothing good.
Yeah, so actually, yes. I mean, this is really a point to think about, right? Because actually, my impression is that people quite often express objections against bad working conditions or bad conditions in which animals live in meat production, for example, and so on, environmental damage. But then when they enter market situations, people seem to focus quite often on prices and profits, and they may also not feel perfectly responsible for how they behave. They see others buying goods that are maybe produced under circumstances that are not that sustainable or ethical. But people then, as a customer, start to support these bad working conditions or production processes by buying these products themselves.
Okay, now, could there be any other reason for why people are more willing to kill mice when there's money involved? Like, could it be possible that the people that killed the mice just didn't like mice? And I'm not saying that to be trite, because I mean, if they don't consider killing mice immoral in the first place, then they're not being any more immoral by killing them for money, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, in all our conditions, we have money involved, right? It's always a trade-off between greed or self-interest in form of receiving money, or killing and killing the animal or saving the animal. This is always the same decision that the people face. It's just the decision context, the framework that differs. In the individual treatment, I decide on my own. I decide if I want to have 10 euros and agree to the killing, or if I want to save the mouse and then I don't get money. And in the markets, this is basically the same decision. It's again receiving a monetary amount and agreeing to kill or saving the life of the mouse. You see, so it's not we have money in all these treatments, because otherwise it would be rather cheap, right? I mean,
right.
People could just say, oh, of course I would like to save this mouse. If there's no trade-off involved, right, then it's really easy to say, let's keep the mouse alive. There has to be some trade-off to make this a morally more complex decision.
Well, I'm wondering if it's the mouse that's the problem, because a lot of people don't feel very, I don't know, emotionally connected to mice. They think they're vermin, they're pests. So what if, do you think the results would have been different if you would have used a more conventionally cute animal, like a rabbit?
My first idea was actually to use these male counterparts of the egg-laying hens. Because in the chicken industry, these male chicken, they typically all get killed as they don't taste that great, yeah? So it doesn't pay out to keep them alive. They get killed right after they are born. And I hope that we could maybe use such animals, because for our study, it was extremely important to us that our study doesn't cause the death of any animals, but instead that we can save animals that would otherwise die for sure. And this is the case for our mice. These were mice from animal laboratories, and they were actually like an overproduction. They were so-called surplus mice. They would all have been killed without our study. They were raised for animal experiments, but it turned out that they were unnecessary for these experiments. And it's actually a sad standard that these animals get gassed. So we used these animals for that reason. But let me come back to the question whether people just consider mice as vermin. We see in the individual condition that the majority of people prefers not to get the 10 euros and to save the mouse life. So from this we see that most people like mice to some extent, yeah, and that they prefer not to get the money and to have the mouse survive in good conditions. So from this, I know that in the market, this cannot be the reason why we observe a drastic increase in willingness to kill. Plus, people express that they feel remorse for their decision. And I think this is because people get tempted into agreeing to kill the mouse, because suddenly in this market context, they may get seduced to agree to the killing. But afterwards, reflecting about their decision, many people realize that this is not in line with their individual standards, and this makes them say, I'm sorry for what I did.
Would we expect different results in different cultures? Like fewer mice murders in Scandinavia, for example? In places with different sort of communal values?
Sure. I mean, this is a very interesting question, and of course the attitude towards mice may actually differ, right? I mean, the mice are just an example of something drastic and irreversible, right? If the animal dies, it's dead. It was not, the point of the paper is not to study the attitudes towards mice. We just took these mice as we had this chance to make them, to give them a chance to survive. And because it is drastic. Of course, it would be interesting to compare different cultures. It could also be that markets have different influences on people depending on whether people come from a market society or not. I mean, in our society, people are really used to act in markets, and they're used to large markets as well, right? And the presence of stock markets even, and so on, could be different in other cultures. And of course, values may differ. I mean, refers to working conditions as well, right? What we consider mm-hmm. as ethical working conditions may be very different from what other societies consider as, justifiable working condition. It's just my impression that by the markets, we very often observe that people start to support working conditions for other people by their buying decisions, that they would outside of the market context object to.
So now, are you going to continue studying this area?
Yeah, definitely. So, we are running follow-up experiments to understand better what is going on. I mean, the market is only, it's a very important institution, but of course there are other institutions that could affect moral behavior as well. For example, decision-making in groups. So it's really interesting to understand how institutions can affect our behavior.
We will absolutely have you back on the show to talk about that.
Thank you.
And very nice to have you here, Nora. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can find a link to Nora Sesh's work, the work that she did with Armin Falk, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, iTunes, and some others I'm probably missing. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes.
Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.